if we can open the conversation, if we can ask, if we can stop assuming that we know all the answers, we can start to create outcomes. And whilst it might be, no, we don't have anything about it yet, let's see what we can do. It doesn't have to be top down at all. Culture is not created top down in any organization. It is co-created by everybody that's there. We have the policies and procedures and the things that we think is the culture. And then if it's done really well, it matches up with the reality, but often there's a disconnect between those two.
Welcome to Mind Over Grind, the podcast that explores mental health, well-being and business for people who sometimes struggle with all three. I'm your host, Alice Lyons, and through running my well-being company and coaching business, I've spoken with hundreds of professionals just like you who think they're doing business wrong. Being in business can suck, but it's a lot more bearable when we have unfiltered conversations around the process. So join me and my guests as we discuss how to work well, stay sane, and maybe even have fun while we're doing it. Hello, lovely. Welcome back to Mind Over Grind. And today I have another interview episode for you. I feel like I start all these interview episodes by saying, hey, I'm going to join my friend such and such, who's an expert in such a thing, who I've known for 4 years and da 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 da. And you might think I'm just going around my friendship group and just interviewing anyone with a pulse just because, you know, they're there and they'll agree because they're my friend. But no, I really know some incredibly cool people and they're so good in all of their specialist areas. It would be remiss of me not to interview them in their area of expertise, and today is no different. I've been meaning to get Leah on for absolutely ages, but she's one of those people that has so many specialisms and so many ways that we could have taken the conversation that I really wanted to wait until I was ready to pitch a particular thing to you that would be of use to you and really practical. So who is Leah? Leah Steele is a career sustainability expert, I would say. I know her through her work around burnout. Burnout is kind of the word that I associate very strongly with Leah. And today we're going to be having a conversation that really breaks through the idea of burnout. Because what I've learned from Leah over the years is that a lot of our preconceived notions of burnout are wrong. A lot of us think that burnout is something that affects people who are unable to cope. It's for people who are maybe underachievers. Maybe their job outstrips their capacity and their capabilities, and therefore they burn out because they're just not good enough to do the job. And this is absolutely not true. If there's one thing I've learned from Leah over the years, it's that the people who are most likely to burn out are the most highly proficient overachievers, if anything. I'll dive into the kind of ins and outs of the episode in just a little bit, but I want to introduce you to Leah properly, first of all. I've known her online for a few years. We have met in real life, I think maybe only once. She actually lives in my hometown of Bristol while I'm kicking around up in the Northwest. But that hasn't stopped us forming a firm friendship over the year, and we are very much comrades in arms in the wellbeing space. We're always passing insights between the two of us around career sustainability and wellbeing at work and just trying to break through some of the nonsense and the noise that's out there. She's a very practical, solutions-driven person. So let me read you the official bio. Leah Steele is a coach, trainer, mentor, and consultant. She's also the founder of a company called Searching for Serenity, and this is focused on helping both individuals and organisations with issues around career sustainability. You'll most often hear Leah talking about burnout, imposter syndrome, stress, and resilience, because those are the issues that affect the productivity, profitability, engagement, enjoyment, and longevity of an individual's career. A former lawyer who experienced her own issues with burnout while she works with clients engaged in large-scale litigation as a result of intense trauma and bereavement, Leah believes that we need brilliant, bright professionals who deserve to be fully resourced to do their very, very necessary work effectively and have a meaningful impact over the long term. That's her official intro, and it doesn't go far enough to tell you what a badass Leah is. She's absolutely incredible. She's going to tell you her backstory of being a lawyer and hitting burnout herself, and her, you know, growing this understanding of what burnout actually is. And the core reason that I wanted to bring this to you today really is that I think a lot of us are burnt out and not actually acknowledging it. That was true pre-pandemic. It got worse during the pandemic, and I think it's even more true now. I have conversations with people every single week who say, oh yeah, you know, it's really tough at the moment, I'm really struggling with this, that, and the other, but I'm not burnt out. And the assumption is because they're still getting up and going to work every day and because they're pushing through, that means they're not burnt out. We have this kind of preconception of it being someone collapsed in a heap and being signed off work and stuff, and that's really not the case. Leah shares a really staggering statistic that says about 70% of us at any one time are suffering from burnout, but we don't know because our understanding of the word is so skewed. So she's going to do a little bit of myth busting today to let you know what burnout actually is. What are the three core kind of pillars of burnout, if you like? Who does it affect? How does it affect us? What does it look like? What are the warning signs to look for? And basically, you're getting a free webinar from Leah right now because she's so good at articulating her points. You can tell she's a podcaster and she does training for a living. She's been in this space for over 6 years, I want to say. And she really, not only does she know her stuff, but she knows how to make it really accessible, really engaging. And keep a sharp ear out while you're listening for some really cool pieces of information. One that I think you'll find particularly useful is the one around insurance and how insurers are actually reducing the insurance premiums of companies who are able to show that they're investing in well-being. I won't say too much more about that now because I want you to hear Leah expand on that, but it's super interesting to see that burnout is actually beginning to be taken more seriously, not only within workplaces, but actually within the legal sphere, and people are being taken to court for failing to look after their employees. And that's a trend that's only going to continue as the years go on, I'm sure. So today's episode is, you're going to get so many bombs, wisdom bombs from Leah today. I honestly think there's no more kind of stigmatized word, unless we go down the mental health route and talking about suicidality and depression. I think the stigma that exists around burnout in the workplace is probably the biggest one that we have that affects so many of us, because we, as a point of pride, I guess, we don't want to admit that we're in that state of burnout ourselves, but so many of us could be. But if you feel like you are after today's episode, don't worry. It doesn't mean you're a failure. This is one of the big points that I've taken away from the episode, is that burnout is not a personal failing. It means there is a failing set somewhere, but it's more often in the systems that exist around individuals rather than the failing being on the part of the individual themselves. So one way that you can help yourself or someone in your team, if you think they're experiencing burnout after today's episode, is obviously to get in touch with Leah. I'll put all of her contact information in the show notes. And to get to that, you just go to the texty part of this episode, click see more, and I'll have all of her links in there. But it's going to be searchingforserenity.co.uk, and you can search for her on LinkedIn, linkedin.com/in/Leah Y Steele, and Steele is spelled STEELE. She's also on Instagram. She's always causing problems over there. It's fabulous. And something that Leah offers that I cannot praise Leah enough, like, her pricing is ridiculous, and I love that she makes it so accessible, but it really frustrates me as a friend and a peer, because she's just giving away so much wisdom and credibility. Like, her experience level is ridiculous, and I really hope she continues increasing her prices after listening to this, because, you know, there are so many other people in the wellbeing space that are charging, you know, tens of thousands of pounds for nothing, and Leah is all insight and wisdom and practical, implementable things. And her prices just do not reflect that. So please go to her website soon and work with her. But one of the ways that you can work with her is through a one-to-one call. I think she calls, what does she call it? A let's talk call. So this is a one-off call. She does it heavily discounted and it's 45 minutes. I had this, I think I was following her and like chatting with her and stuff for a couple of years before I booked it up. I thought, you know what, she seems to know her stuff, and it's only whatever it was at the time, 30 quid or something for 45 minutes. I thought, that is an absolute steal, forgive the pun. But I booked it, and I swear to God, within the first 10 minutes, I'd more than got the value of the 30 quid, but I was just like, she really knows her stuff. She just drilled. It was like she saw into my soul. She could see all of the things that I wasn't saying around like how stressed out I was or how burnt out I was. And obviously, as someone in the wellbeing space, that's a bit of a taboo. It's like, oh, if you're not looking after yourself, how can you possibly support your clients? And there's all this kind of double layer of stigma. And anyone that's a leader will feel the same thing. If you're a caregiver, if you're a manager, you feel that kind of additional pressure to like be good and be switched on and be seen to be strong and coping and all the rest of it. And she saw through that in a couple of minutes. And she was able to offer from like the first 10 minutes, she was offering me advice or she was asking me a question. And I just felt like, this woman gets it. She is super switched on. So I really, really encourage you to book one of those Let's Talk calls. If it's not for yourself, book it and have a talk to her about your team. You will not regret it. You'll get so much from that conversation. And it's one of those things where I think if you get on with me and my style, you will very much resonate with Leah. One of the disclaimers I have to give for today's episode is there's a fair amount of swearing, not loads and loads, but I think a couple of F-bombs get in there from memory. It was a very lively discussion, but that's just because she's awesome and she expresses herself very colourfully with her language, which I'm all for, as you know. Another slight warning, this is a really nerdy one. This is more for my benefit. I'm sure, I don't know how many of you this will affect, but it bothers me when I listen to a podcast and the audio is not 100%. So despite us both having beautiful microphones, really high quality audio equipment, we did a sound check on the day, everything was fine. But when we came to when it came to post-production and editing this episode, I noticed there was a bit of a discrepancy. My mic was really low, so we had to boost it and all these like nerdy things. Long and short of it is there are a couple of messy edits, I think, where it's bits have been cut out where we were like talking over each other or the sound was just doing wibbly wobbly things. So there are a couple of quite dramatic like cuts in here. They were done as cleanly as could be done. And hopefully it's not too distracting. I think I only notice it because I kind of know it's there and I'm a bit of a geek. But if you think you've skipped a few seconds or if you find it a bit jarring, that's all that is. It's not, there. Do not adjust your set. It's fine. I don't think you'll find it too distracting. The volume is fine and all the rest of it. So I will leave you in the very capable hands of Leah. What I will say after this episode is please, 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 if you find it insightful, if you find yourself learning something new, A, please get in touch with Leah and form a relationship with her because she is as good as you think she is from listening to this episode and more. If you think this anything touches on any of the problems that you have in your workplace, anything that you've seen with your team, get her in, have a conversation. As she will say, the very fact that we're having conversations and opening it up around burnout is really breaking through that stigma. But more important than that, it's allowing us to actually put measures in place to prevent it. And that is so important at this moment in time. We are still fatigued after the pandemic. Things have not returned to normal as expected. And Leah, I can 100% guarantee you she will be able to help you with her insights. So please do consider getting in touch with her. And just allow yourself to feel whatever you're feeling after this episode. Like, I've listened back to it two or three times since recording it, and I'm still gaining new insights and a deeper level of kind of appreciation and understanding for myself, and just being like, do you know what? It's okay. It's okay if you burn out. It's not a failing. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It doesn't mean you're bad at your job. It doesn't mean any of those things. It just means you're a very highly, not necessarily a highly intelligent human, but you're a highly capable person who wants to do really well. Your heart is in the right place. And maybe the circumstances have conspired against you. But that is the first step for turning the boat around. And anything you can do, any adjustments you can put in place for one person will undoubtedly have a positive net benefit for other people in your workplace as well. So excited for this one. Get in touch with Leah. I'm going to say it again. Get in touch with Leah. Okay. I will leave you with her now. Thank you so much for listening. And I will see you next time.
So hi, everybody. Welcome back to Mind Over Grind. And I'm joined today by the resplendent, the shimmering, the gorgeous Leah Steele from Searching for Serenity. Hey, Leah.
Hello. How are you?
I'm really good. Thank you so much for coming on today to talk about your specialist area, which is burnout prevention.
Thank you.
But rather than me introduce you, I wonder if you'd like to give a little brief intro to who you are and what you do and who you help.
I love how you phrase it brief because you know I won't otherwise. So my name's Leah Steele. I run a business called Searching for Serenity. Essentially, what I do is provide mentoring, coaching, training and education for both individuals and organizations all around issues affecting career sustainability. So I'm talking about burnout, imposter syndrome, stress, resilience, those tiny inconsequential issues that affect almost nobody. So that's who I am. That's what I do. And it's very much about, for me, having these conversations with people, because if we don't have the conversations, then nothing's going to change, right?
Absolutely. And we've been having these kind of conversations probably on Instagram for about 6 years or so, maybe not that long, but I think we've known each other for easily 3 years, I think, if not four.
Yeah.
So you've been doing this work for a long time, but I wonder if you can take us back a little bit to how you got into this work, what kind of brought you to this?
Yeah, so as we're recording this, I've been doing this for 6.5 years, which is terrifying. So before I started Searching for Serenity, I was a lawyer. This is where everybody gets scared and switches off, right? I was a lawyer. I practiced in law for just over a decade. So I decided I wanted to become a lawyer when I was 9 years old, because I was a precocious brat, but also because I saw lawyers as people who fixed problems, right? A lawyer took me from a very scary place as a small child and made the world a better place. And so my tiny brain went, I want to do that. Not only because it's good, because presumably if I'm that side of the table, I don't have any problems in my life. Fast forward a few years, 20 or so, and I qualified as a solicitor. I had to work for 6 years before I qualified, and I had been working second and third jobs on top of my 9-to-5 in order to qualify. So by the time I qualified, I'd worked 6 years as a paralegal, unqualified lawyer, and I'd worked an extra 3 years in paid overtime and second jobs. That didn't include the early starts, late finishes, the working through lunch. So it meant I'd been working around 80 to 90 hours a week on average for 6 years. Unsurprisingly, that was somewhat unsustainable. And a couple of years after I qualified, there I was sitting in the toilets at work, Googling my symptoms. I was exhausted. I was overwhelmed. Just didn't feel like I could keep up with everything. According to Ask MD Online, I was dead. But then I came across the idea of burnout, and that made more sense to me. And as I seem to still be alive, I'm very pale on this recording right now, but I seem to still be alive.
Not definitely not dead. Officially a ghost.
No, kind of working my way through zombieism. It is January. So, yeah, basically all of the symptoms were either saying that I was really chronically unwell or I had burnout, and I was going to the doctor. I wasn't particularly physically unwell. And so I started looking into what burnout was, and it really built from there. I actually started searching for Serenity whilst I was still a lawyer, because just working with people with traumatic brain injuries, and managing like £20 million. Oh my God. That job taught me so much. But I actually started the business because I'd started talking about burnout. And really the question for me was, why do so many brilliant people leave their careers 6 to 10 years in? That was what the question was to me at that point. And then burnout was coming into it. The picture started to unfold. But I actually ran the business in evenings and weekends around a full-time job in law, because I felt like, how can I possibly say to people, yes, you can fix these things, yes, it's manageable and reversible, yes, it's all okay, if the only way I did it was to leave first?
Yeah, interesting what you preached there.
Yeah, which is really annoying. I wish I wasn't quite so ethical. It would be so much easier if I wasn't. So I was open with clients. I was working full-time as a lawyer and doing this in evenings and weekends. And my theory was, if I can manage a reverse burnout whilst working full-time and helping other people with it, who can't? And it's really developed from there. So I've been doing corporate work for 3 years as well now. Just over 3 years, 4 years this year, actually. I know what maths is. 4 years this year, and working with private clients for 6.5 years. So yeah, it's developing at pace.
Just a side note for myself to pick up on next time is we need to have a separate conversation at some point about how to build a business, like as a side hustle and in your part-time and stuff, because that's kind of an option that's not explored by many people. And actually, sometimes people find it much more successful to do that rather than having a lifestyle business that you put too much attention on. But that'll be a story for another day, I think. So talk to me about burnout, because first of all, I found it really interesting that you didn't start from a complete rock bottom. Like, you often hear about people who have these kind of revelations around their well-being and stuff when they hit a crisis of like, I cannot physically get myself to work today. I cannot. But it sounds like you were actually still functioning. So maybe that's a really good place to start with what burnout actually is, because you're saying you're burnt out, but you haven't hit that wall yet, which I find really interesting.
Well, I mean, some would argue that, like Wile E. Coyote, I'd hit the wall, gone through it, left like a human shape in it, and was out the other side. Naturally, that's what it's like with burnout, because this is the first thing. If I'm delivering like a burnout prevention session to organizations, because I'm super professional, the first thing I do is have a whole slide set of GIFs explaining what people think burnout is, right? And on that slide, I've got somebody closing their laptop and throwing it out the window. We've got Moss from the IT crowd with the office on fire. We've got Stephen Colbert screaming with his hands all over his face, because that's what people think burnout is, right? They think burnout is non-functional. You've been signed off sick, or you've had to quit your job. You have to go and live in a beach hut in Bali to recover from it. That was the advice that I was actually given. Well, not the advice. The study that I first read when I came across burnout crying in the toilets Bearing in mind at this point, I was a contentious probate litigator. I'd been working in law for more than a decade. It had been my life's plan for more than 20 years. And what I read was, once you've experienced burnout, you have to eradicate all stress from your life because you can never handle stress again. Now, can you imagine, one, getting that advice where I was sitting at that point, literally in the toilets crying? And two, can you imagine telling somebody that after the last couple of years we've had? Pandemic, recession, cost of living crisis, you know, war in Ukraine, you name it, we cannot eradicate stress from our lives.
It's irresponsible to even suggest that, isn't it? If like, oh, imagine having that much privilege that you could just say, oh, okay, I'll just cash in my chips and go and sit on a beach. Like, wonderful.
And yet you hear it all the time. I did this a couple of weeks ago with ChatGPT, that AI software.
Yeah.
I asked it to write an article about burnout and every single thing. How to recover from burnout, everything was an individualistic solution. Have a bubble bath, take a holiday, quit your job.
And actually, burnout with baths, if that worked, we wouldn't have a problem.
If that worked, me changing jobs would have fixed it, because that's what I did, right? This is the advice I was getting. So changed jobs, changed area of law, changed firms, changed locations. It wasn't working. Why? Because actually I was removing the stuff that gave me the reward, that I felt good, that I was good at, the people that supported me. And I was putting myself into an environment that I was uncomfortable in, that I wasn't good at, with people that didn't support me, didn't necessarily like me or what I was doing. You know, I got all the bad advice to begin with. But anyway, so, you know, when we're talking about burnout, people think it is signed off sick, can't work. And it's this tiny little niche of the population that is, you know, signed off living on benefits, collecting their income protection insurance, whatever it might be. It's actually not. So burnout, the World Health Organization's definition of burnout, is chronic workplace stress that's not been successfully managed, and that it has three key dimensions: exhaustion and depletion, negativity, cynicism, and increased mental distance from one's job, and reduced professional efficacy. Basically, if you are waking up more tired every day, struggling with your to-do list and wondering why you're bothering, you're experiencing burnout.
Congratulations and welcome.
Welcome to the world. And actually, that is the world. So, you know, we've had, one of the issues with burnout is because it's not a clinical diagnosis, and it's referred to as an occupational phenomenon. I always stumble over that phrase. And then I start hearing the Muppets singing phenomenon in my head. Really dating myself with this, aren't I? But it's an occupational phenomenon. So it's a collection of symptoms. It's a reason why you might interact with a medical professional. And so a lot of the studies, you know, it's very bitty. It's all over the place. It's not centralized in the same way recovery tools are not centralized in the same way as, say, anxiety and depression would be. And the other thing around it is all of the studies that I've been reading over the last 5 years have seen an increase in burnout. So Gallup in 2018 ran a poll of US workers, and they found 23% were burned out all the time, 44% some of the time or often. So 67% of workers experiencing some level of burnout. They ran the same poll again 2 years later, and the overall figures had jumped from 67 to 76%, three quarters of workers experiencing some level of burnout. That was March 2020.
I wonder what happened around about then.
I know, right? And actually, the data predated COVID, right? Because they released it in March 2020. I can't see they've done an update since then. I think they're too scared or burned out too. But Deloitte do a lot of work on this because they were involved in the original Stevenson and Farmer report in 2017, which was commissioned by the Conservative government to find out the costs of poor mental health for UK employers. And since 2017 to 2022, because that's the latest data we've got, the cost of poor mental health for UK employers has risen by around 60%. It was around 35 billion. We're talking 56 billion now.
I didn't realize it jumped so much in such a short time. That's
And Deloitte do these updates every year where they're talking about the case for investment in mental health, and they talk a lot about burnout. So in 2022, they did a study again, an update, and they found that 77% of workers had experienced burnout in their current job. So not just generally over the course of their life, but in their current job. But alongside that, 87% of people still had passion for their career. And this is the issue, right? Because my definition of burnout is it's something that happens to people who care and give a lot for themselves, who work too hard for too long with too little care and reward. And I then go on to say that it happens to the best and brightest who give generously themselves and ask for too little in return. And when we're talking about that, we're talking about people who care about an outcome, who, you know, I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to make a difference in people's lives. So that means we'll stay in the room longer, even as the temperature gets turned up too high. We'll continue trying to create these outcomes, even when it's hurting us. And so my joke is often, I try and help people feel like work isn't a form of self-harm. It's not that much of a joke.
That's a very dark joke.
That's light for me. What are you talking about?
But it's so interesting when you talk about the reality of what burnout actually is and calling it a sort of phenomenon rather than, you know, a condition. I think we have got into this very almost like medicalized way of talking about it, where it's kind of hush-hush, it's shameful, it's something that we don't want to admit that's happening. But what you've just said there is it's actually something that affects the majority. This is the norm, is for most of us to feel not only burnt out, but burnt out now, like in our current roles, in the work that we're doing.
Yeah, it's very much pathologized. And what most people don't understand is you can live in a habitualized form of burnout for years, if not decades. So if we say the standard is exhaustion, depletion, negativity, cynicism, and reduced professional efficacy, if you look back over your career, how long have you been feeling tired? How long have you felt like your to-do list is getting on top of you? How long have you felt like, why am I doing this? Or the reason why I'm doing this is so far removed from where I started. And there's five stages to burnout. Most of us... I had a penny for every person on LinkedIn who said to me, I'm not burned out yet, but here's the list of symptoms. Yeah. And they think they're in the plateau stage because we think it's plateau, crisis, dead. It's not. I mean, dead, jokingly, obviously. It's plateau, crisis. And then what happens after that? It's how we keep going after we've had these massive issues, whether it's illness, job issues, cost of living crisis, pandemic, you know, we're on the other side of it and we're all feeling exhausted and drained and struggling. That's burnout. And we will do things to keep ourselves in that state for years, if not decades.
And I know we've spoken about this before, where we've spoken about the kind of meta picture of everybody coming through COVID, because COVID was like the crisis and we all just kind of had to get our heads down. And actually, I think a lot of us cope really well in a crisis. But like you say, it's what's happened once you've gone through the war and you keep going. It's that chronic exhaustion. And I think that's really what we've seen, particularly 2022, because 2021 seemed a bit more permissive of like, we're not expecting things to be back to normal, but, you know, let's just do what we can. And then 2022, a lot of employers seem to be pushing back to return to the office, return to normal. And like, we forgot about all those lessons we learned in 2020 about maybe slowing down, maybe working differently, maybe working more flexibly. It seemed like that kind of fell away a little bit in the kind of professional realms in 2022. But us as individuals, we're actually still here like, actually, I'm exhausted and really burnt out.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is why, right? We saw the Great Resignation, because we saw a shift in a lot of people's values, in a lot of people's priorities, in what they were prepared to do. And every study that I look at, you see people who give a lot, who are overperforming, right? We got told that a lot of offices, a lot of employers wanted people back in the office because they thought they were having a skive at home. Whereas actually studies show that if you are a remote worker, that's really difficult to say, you're more likely to work overtime than an in-office worker. Why? Because you haven't got the commute, because you can work a little bit longer and it'll be okay. But also because work from home is still seen as a privilege and a boon and a bounty. And so it creates more engagement and therefore you give more, right? So we're back to that. I have passion for, therefore I'm going to overperform. That's a cycle that you keep seeing come up. And particularly with burnout. So I find it really interesting. We've had the Great Resignation. There's a lot of evidence to see a lot of people have changed their jobs. I'm actually seeing a lot of people changing their jobs right now as well. Yeah. And I think this is going to keep happening because there's a disconnect. There's a miscommunication that's happening between what we need and what we get. Mm. Right. So until we can match those, we're going to keep searching.
For serenity.
I know, it's in my head every time I say the word.
So from what you've said there, burnout is not only something that affects the majority, but maybe affects people that we wouldn't expect. So you were talking about overachievers, you were talking about people who really care about their work, people who are really engaged with their work. So it's like, oh crap, it doesn't matter how much you love your job, it can happen to the best of us and all of us. So who suffers? Would you say we're all, it's something that we can all experience, or are there certain people that will never ever get burnout and are just born to chill?
I think there are some people who are born to chill. I think it's a minority of people for a good reason, because when we're talking about burnout, I do this thing with my fingers, right? Because it's the intersectionality between who we are as individuals and the culture we're working within. So if I'm working in an environment where I'm constantly trying to achieve an outcome, and I'm stymied or prevented, but encouraged. So, you know, I was a lawyer. I was constantly trying to get those settlements. I was constantly trying to get what my clients wanted, get what my client wants, onto the next one, onto the next one. Because you've always got 30, 50, at one point, 250 clients. Mm-hmm. So it's onto the next all the time. And so there's enough carrot to keep you going. Mm-hmm. But there's also all these barriers, this noise, this friction, these distractions, these things that are holding you back, IT issues, not being promoted, not getting what you need, having a bad day, right? And so you just keep going. And so it's that intersectionality between who you are and the environment. If I'm in an environment that does not work for me, I'm not going to overperform. Whereas if you put me in an environment where people tell me that I'm lovely and they like me and they really appreciate what I do, and can you just take on this really difficult client because you're so good with the difficult clients, I lap that up. I'm fully aware of it. Every office I've ever worked in, I've been given the difficult clients because they are so good with difficult people. I've been given difficult matters because, oh, you know, we just really need your help. And none of those people, by the way, have been doing that in any way maliciously. It's been because it's about how we allocate stuff out. So whilst there are some people that will never experience burnout, I think it's becoming less and less likely. Historically, I don't think burnout was as much of an issue. It wasn't as commonly talked about because of the way we resourced people. Mm-hmm. So if we go back, my grandparents, for example, they're in the 90s. They don't understand burnout. My grandmother never worked, really. She had odd jobs until she got married, and then she was a homemaker and she looked after the kids. My grandfather went to work, but he got to come home. He didn't have a mobile because they didn't bloody exist. He didn't have email because it didn't exist. Nobody was phoning the landline at night saying, hey, there's a problem at the cash, it wasn't cash carry, it was building supplies place. So when it was shut, it was shut. That was it. When he was having a day off, he was having a day off, and that was it. So resourcing was done differently. Now we don't have one person managing the home and one at work. We are all doing it, mm-hmm. all of the things all at once. And usually doing it whilst we've got AirPods in, cooking dinner with a notification coming up from our work emails and a WhatsApp from our junior saying, hey, have you thought about this? You know, we have much more of a flood of information. We're resourced differently. We have different expectations. And so I think we're going to see a lot more of this over the next few years because we're reaching a balancing up point now, right? Where people are beginning to turn off the notifications, get separate work phones, talk about work-life balance. We didn't, even when I started my career 20 years ago, we didn't talk about work-life balance. It was work hard and climb the ladder. Mm. And that was it. We're seeing more of a sea change now. So anybody who is experiencing burnout, here's what I know about them. They care a lot. They give a lot. They want to create some kind of outcome. And that could be for themselves, getting promoted, getting the pay rise they need, building a business. It could be for other people, getting outcomes for their clients, creating that great piece of software that's going to change the world. Most likely it's going to be both. It's a mix of altruism and selfishness, or however you want to phrase it, self-interest. They are often people pleasers. They will put themselves out for others. They care a lot about others. Doesn't mean they have to be a bleeding heart all the time. There's usually a balance, and often there is. As we get deeper into burnout, we get more negativity and cynicism, disengagement. But they are often the people who will struggle with imposter syndrome.
who will not believe that their successes are their own. But whenever there's a failure, they take it really personally. Mm-hmm. They have a high level of dedication. These are the people that we want to be doing a brilliant job for a really long time. And that's not happening when they're experiencing burnout. Mm-hmm. It means with burnout, it means your productivity goes down, your engagement goes down, your ability to deal with things in a crisis diminishes because you're so exhausted. That's when we start having staff turnover. That's when we have presenteeism, which is the single biggest cost to UK employers for poor mental health, by the way. 49% of that 56 billion is due to presenteeism. If we put a Venn diagram, reduce professional efficacy and burnout and presenteeism, there's a big overlap between them. So really, who experiences burnout is anyone who gives a crap and wants to create an outcome and is a good person and cares a lot. That's most of us, right?
Which is so different from the age old kind of stigma that we attach to it. It's like, oh, it's people that can't cope. It's underperformers, if anything. That would be the word I would historically have associated with it. It's like,
yeah,
you're not able to cope with the demands of your job. It's a personal failing. But actually what you're saying there is like, yes, we have particular character traits that lend themselves to burnout, but it's very much a blend of the context as well that we're operating within and the circumstances. And one of the things that you've said a lot in your work is it's not a personal failing, it's a systemic problem. So yeah. If we could dive into that a little bit more and think about what are the systemic problems that you see a lot with the people you work with that lend, almost like contribute and almost create a petri dish where can thrive.
Yeah, absolutely. So I often say burnout is a systemic issue that gives rise to symptoms in individuals, right? So what you've just said there about underperformers, that's the classic idea. They're snowflakes, they can't cope. It's not. What we have is overperformers who have, much like all of us, it's January as we record this, all of us who overspent at Christmas and are up against the edge of our overdrafts. It doesn't mean that we're negligent and awful with money. It means that we've overspent at this point and we need to pull back. But with burnout, we are incentivized to overspend our energy all the time, right? Pay rise, promotion, bonus, work hard, the badge of honor that so many have of, I'm just so busy and important. We're constantly given these messages of do more, be more, have more, right? And be a better person, be a smarter person, work more efficiently, work more productively. How to hack your email system, how to, you know, manage all these things, these hacks that we have for everything, right? And actually, what happens is the overperformer overextends their energy and then underperforms as the pendulum swings. What we want to do is keep the overperformer overperforming at a healthy and sustainable level. You know, going above and beyond is something that is like fresh air and sunshine for most of us. We love it. We love getting outcomes. We love when people are happy, when we get positive feedback. We want to keep that going for longer. So yeah, that's the biggest thing when it comes to the systemic, is this misunderstanding. So what do I mean by systemic? When we're talking about a systemic issue, we are talking about, it's not just about the individual, it's about everything that's going on around them. Now, the World Health Organization's definition of burnout very clearly says that it's only about the occupational context. Personally, I think that's a bit rubbish. It was written pre-pandemic, and I think we have effectively smashed those things together now, home, personal, work, everything at once. But we're often told to bring our whole selves to work, which means our whole selves come with all that baggage too. So when we're talking about the systems people operate in, we're talking about the expectations, the culture, the support, the drains, demands, all of it at once. And if you imagine, we zoom out and we're looking down on a person who has burnout. We've got all these overlapping circles around them. And they're going to be their work, but not just their work, their team, the wider organization, the industry that they're part of. All of these things have different competing demands and cultures, and they all interlink and overlay, and sometimes they conflict each other. We're also talking about the personal. We're talking about home, family life, what support we have. We're talking about whether we grew up in a religion. We're talking about what the culture is. You know, UK culture is very different from US culture, which is very different from Australian culture. Yeah, a lot of UK lawyers go to Australia because they do have a better work-life balance. but they get paid differently and the structures are very different, right? So when we're talking about the systemic context, first of all, we have to understand burnout arises as a result of chronic workplace stress that's not successfully managed. That's not the individual hasn't successfully managed it. How much can you pile on somebody and still expect them to cope with? The image that I use for a lot of clients is a GIF of a beaker of hydrochloric acid. I love my GIFs, as you know. Beaker of hydrochloric acid, and you're putting a teaspoon in it, and the teaspoon dissolves. Mm-hmm. Do we blame the teaspoon or the acid? But when it's a person at work, we blame the person, they're the teaspoon, right? But when it's a vat of acid dissolving something, the acid is dissolving it. When we're talking about chronic workplace stress, we place the focus on the individual, not the organization, not the wider systemic culture. And actually, we need to take a step back. We need to look at what's going on, because particularly as we have overperformers that then become underperformers, we need to look at how the systemic structures, the organization, the team, the wider industry, the pressures they're under, what we learned from our family and friends, all of these things come into play. And that makes it really complex, but that also makes it brilliant, because it's more likely to be a long-term solution. If I tell you to go and have a bubble bath to fix burnout, that's great for about 40 minutes until the water goes cold. If I tell you to look at your beliefs, your behaviors, your maladaptive coping mechanisms, your workload, how your systems keep crashing at work, and we need to talk about whether your laptop needs an upgrade, we work on all of those and we've got 10 different ways to fix burnout. So that's why I think it's so important. We need to, particularly for organizations, I actually think it's quite empowering for an organization to understand that it's a systemic issue, because it means they have some skin in the game. Not just writing people off and saying, oh, well, that one burned out, put another log on the fire.
Yeah,
that's not the way it works with people. And if we want to develop great people who stay with organizations for the long term, that means getting involved.
So how do you even begin to approach this? Because everything you've just said right there, you're not absolving individuals of any responsibility. Far from it. You're saying there are lots of things we can do at an individual level, but it also needs to come in tandem with collective and kind of group solutions. So a lot of the ways that we typically see burnout spoken about is like, come to this webinar, go to this workshop. But I find they're very individualistic in terms of the solutions they offer, which is great because it will help individuals relieve their own symptoms. So that has a place and it has a value. But what are some other ways that people could approach this that are maybe more sustainable, operate at a higher level? What other kind of things could supplement that?
So with burnout, we need a full and complete solution, right? Because if I'm experiencing burnout that's reducing my productivity, then my productivity has gone down by a third. I engage in individualistic solutions. My productivity might rise a little bit, 5-10%. It might even go right up for a short time, but it's not sustainable because we're talking about the amount of energy that's going into creating that fix, right? Whereas if we're talking about individual plus systemic, we then have two massive things to play with. We can look at what's going on with workloads, with balance, with training, with support, with different structures. And I have a whole viewpoint on this as well. And it means that we can make more effective long-term changes that aren't just focused on one person constantly trying to fix themselves. And that's how it's always felt with burnout, right? One person has to go and fix themselves and the rest of the world just toddles along as normal. So what are the things that organizations can do? I'm never going to say that training isn't helpful, because actually, you know, this conversation, you've been seeing me for 4 years and we still have those, you know, those tropes that come up, and there's little bits. Every time you and I have a conversation, there's a nugget that one of us gives to the other about well-being, right? And so training is so important, not just because of training. It's not just about giving people skills. It's about opening the conversation. If we can open the conversation, we start to create psychological safety. We start to create a culture in which people feel supported and they feel, and I hate the word empowered, but there's no better one. They feel empowered. I know.
I just did an air grab for listeners.
it's such a weighty and almost meaningless word at times. But what we want to do is
We want to create a culture where people feel safe to speak up, safe to raise issues earlier. That's going to improve compliance. That's going to create more iterative solutions earlier. It's going to mean that we're using crowdsourcing solutions rather than expecting one person at the top of the business to fix everything. That pressure is ridiculous. So training is a great place to start to open the conversation, not as a tick box that's done, but as a start to something more. So whenever I do training for firms, I deliver the training. I also do a survey at the end. I anonymize the results and I create an in-depth report for the wellbeing team or for the managers to say, this is what your staff want. Here's a list of 12 different trainings that lead into burnout, because this is the thing. Burnout's the tip of the iceberg. It's career sustainability is the whole icy chunk, but we're seeing it with burnout because we're seeing people not performing, underperforming, being exhausted, being snappy, being rude. So the first thing is to shift training from being the solution to being the start. That's the first thing. The second thing that organizations can do is invest in this multi-strand support. So again, we usually, the traditional is you go to a training, you get the notes, you put them on the shelf, you say that was really helpful, and you never look at them again until you've quit that job and you're packing up your shelves. What we want to do is embed it. We want to embed cultures and well-being policies and understanding. So we're not sprinkling little bits of fairy dust everywhere. We're instead making it part of our everyday. Mm-hmm. How can we get people to speak up earlier? My favorite is when organizations say, we have an open door policy. I go, okay, how many people walk through the door? And they say, what? And I say, how many people walk through the door? You've got an open door policy, but how many people have used it? Oh, yeah. Opening the door isn't enough. Training isn't enough. It's what happens after that. And, you know, before we started recording, I was ranting at you about this, how there's a whole mechanism behind this, about how actually training is the starting point, but wellbeing initiatives are the starting point. It's about the embedded culture. It's about demonstrating what we're doing long term and how it's improving all of these outcomes: engagement, staff turnover, staff retention, compliance, iterative solutions. If we can create all of that, that ecosystem, then we have an environment in which we are more likely to speak up early. We are more likely to ask for help. We are more likely to innovate solutions. We are more likely to offer support as well, because we have less people experiencing high levels of burnout and therefore more capacity within the system. I also have very strong views, having come from an area of, well, a couple of areas of law that are very demanding, very emotionally demanding. You know, I work with a lot of law firms, and my go-to is lawyers need supervision. Lawyers need an opportunity and a safe space to share, because if they don't, then they're taking on all of this stuff and there's nowhere for it to go. You know, I used to work with people who were recently bereaved, who were traumatized after family members had been injured, and it just all soaked up with me. And if, you know, I'm not going to repeat it because you need all the trigger warnings in the world at the front of this podcast, and that gets into a whole other territory. But, you know, I have sat there with people crying with PTSD, with very severe symptoms and no support for me behind. So whether it's that extreme end of the kind of support I was offering people, or whether it's because we understand the stress of the job, we understand high volume, low control. We understand if you're client facing that sometimes those clients are going to scream and shout and it's going to be awful. But we understand that all of that energy has somewhere it needs to go. And we can't just expect people to take it home, or as we are doing now, work remotely and then just walk out of their spare bedroom and it's all okay. That's not the way it works. So again, it's about providing more resources for people in the long term.
Really good case for building the business case for getting you in, because the more you speak, the more complexity is added in, because like you're talking there about a few different things that you can implement. It's not just about, like you said, getting the one-off training and getting the expert in every so often. It's about, how do you embed that? Well, you embed that through offering support systems, whether that's peer support, whether that's having a professional like hold that space for them, whether it's one-on-one support. It is really complicated to take on. So if there was someone listening who was had their very skeptical hat on, maybe they're in burnout very deep for themselves, so all the cynicism and things, yep, like that, it seems like such a big problem to tackle. So why should they do it? Like, is there really, is it a necessity or is it a nice to have, would you say?
It is absolutely a necessity. The reason for that is simple. Okay. First of all, it's the right thing to do for people. We'll come back to that in a minute. Financially, if you want your business to survive and if you want your business to be profitable, what's the number one thing that the majority of businesses that are listening to this, what's their number one cost? People. How do they create their money? By what people create. We are not talking about factory lines. We are not talking about, you know, even AI. Someone has to program it, right? If you want people to create a profit, then we have to keep them in that productive sweet spot. They will not stay in that productive sweet spot if they are burned out. Whether you did it, whether someone else did it, I don't care. If you want a good outcome, keep them in the productive sweet spot by addressing burnout symptoms. Because if they start experiencing burnout, I have, I might share them with you actually, these images. I have three kind of archetypes. I hate that word again. But three archetypes of the previously brilliant employee who has become a burnout. Burned out, overwhelmed, exhausted. So the previously really solid performer who was just, you know, they did their job, they did well, they were quiet. All of a sudden they've become a firebrand. They are swearing up a storm because everything the employer does is a nightmare and they hate them. And they're taking everybody with them. They're creating these waves. Or the overperforming quiet introvert who suddenly become the ghost. But you don't notice because they're still overperforming. So the margin between their level of performance and a substandard level of performance has a way to go. So you don't notice as they're sliding and sliding, and they'll eventually leave. Or the superhuman who overperforms, does everything, does cakes with bake sale on top of it. Anything that needs doing, I'll fix it. But then that energy starts becoming really edgy. And you're just waiting for them to implode and they keep dropping the ball and they don't do it well, but they're so great that no one wants to say anything. You know, these are the kind of things that we're talking about here, that people shift. And if you want to keep people superhuman overperformers, if you want to keep the introvert who is great at programming and just gets on with it, or you want your solid performer to stay, we have to address the causes of burnout. Because at the moment, presenteeism costs UK employers $35 billion a year. Something like that. 25, 35, I don't know. It's in the $30 billion range. Maths is not my strong point, okay? I need the figures in front of me to do it.
People, come on.
56 divided by 2. Okay, whatever that is. $26 billion, I think it is. But anyway, that's the first, the financial case, right? So how much productivity is lost? The second financial case is where you're spending money. Staff turnover, absenteeism, where people are going off sick for long term. Disability discrimination, by the way. We have now had the first disability discrimination case on the basis of burnout at the Employment Tribunal. There are more on the way. Because when somebody experiences burnout, whilst it's not a diagnosis like a broken leg or depression, it is a reason why they will interact with a medical professional. They are more likely to experience symptoms such as anxiety, depression. They will be signed off sick for stress, and it can create an adjustment disorder as well. And so we have now had cases where people have come back having said, I have burnout, I've been signed off sick, they've come back to work, their organization has failed to take control of the issue, and as a result they have gotten worse. They have then been asked to leave or have left and have come back and said, hang on a minute, I experienced an adjustment disorder as a result of the stress, depression, and anxiety I received following burnout. And you didn't make reasonable adjustments to care for me. I don't know what that one was worth. We haven't seen the settlement details. It's been made private, but it made big headlines just over a year ago when it hit the papers. And I know that there are more cases of high performing lawyers who have left their careers and are pursuing their previous employers for it. So what money are you losing? What money are you spending? What claims are on the horizon? What expenses do you have in your organization that could be minimized? So we were talking before we started about law firms all have to invest in professional indemnity insurance. You're not allowed to practice law without it. And it's a cost of tens of thousands for most firms, if not more. And it's gone up recently a lot. The underwriters, the people who are setting the terms of that insurance and setting that premium, want to see well-being. In order to lower premiums, they want to see that the the policies that are in place are actually reality, not just rhetoric. They're looking at staff costs. They're looking at the staff to profit ratio.
Insurers are actively looking for proof that organizations are investing in well-being, and in so doing, they're able to lower their insurance premiums, presumably because the insurers think that that lowers the risk of payouts.
Yeah, of payouts. For law firms in particular, because particularly in law firms, you're doing high value work. So I only needed to screw up one case to have a professional indemnity insurance claim that was worth millions. Mm. So it, just the same as if you don't drive into the back of the car in front of you all the time, you're going to get a lower car insurance premium. If you are in an industry where you have professional indemnity insurance in order to do your job, how are you a better driver? We were all used to taking the advanced driver course when we passed our test, right? Mm-hmm. But are you better at your job? Are you safer at your job? So yeah, that's the underpinning of that. If you're safer at your job, if you're in an industry that is heavily regulated, I can only speak from the legal perspective right now. I don't know about the other industries, but if we're seeing it in law, we're going to be seeing it elsewhere if we're not already. So there's four different financial reasons why you should invest. And that's before we get to the fact it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, ethics, you know, let's not forget ethics, but a lot of people, even if you only come down on one side of this argument, it's a very comprehensive argument for it, isn't it?
And then we're talking about who you want to keep, what culture you want in your firm. Do you want that churn, or do you want people who stick with you for the long term and who know what they're doing and are the people that are great in a crisis? What kind of organization do you want to build? Do you want to constantly be recruiting, or do you want to be able to get on and do your damn job? That's part of the burnout equation. You know, all of these things come into play. So there are financial reasons, there are ethical reasons, there are cultural reasons. And what I'm aiming to do with organizations is to create workplaces where people speak up early, where we innovate change, where we get ahead of the burnout issue, where we're not looking at people just slowly sliding off and disappearing, getting signed off sick, coming back, getting signed off, disappearing, never coming back, or where people just, I ran a poll on LinkedIn over the weekend for lawyers, and it terrified me because 62% of the people who responded said they didn't feel comfortable talking about burnout at work. Yeah. And 18% of them would rather quit than ever have the conversation with their manager.
Do you think that's because of the stigma around it, of it's a personal failing, it's you at fault?
So the conversations that came up, the words that were mentioned were weak, personal failing, stigma, and solutions. There are a whole, remember I said at the beginning, people who are people pleasers, overperformers. These are people who have their eyes on your business. They see how things can be improved. They also see when you're stressed. So if they've got a manager who is stressed out, they won't raise burnout because I'm just adding to their load. And I know there's no policies and procedures and no capacity and no resources to help them. So I'll just stick with it. I'll just manage it myself. And they keep going and keep going until they can no longer cope. Then sickness, trying to get a new job, or just underperforming. So we're talking not just about, you know, what we're doing on an individual day-by-day basis. We're talking about policies, procedures, systems, knowing that something is in place. And that was the thing that came up more than most. What's the point of me raising this? I know nothing can happen. And actually, that's gutting for me, because those are the organizations who probably do have something in place, but it's not very well communicated. Mm-hmm. Or they would do it if you asked, because they think they've got an open door policy and it'll all be okay. And actually, they just don't realize no one's walking through the door because they haven't seen the solution for them. This is where modeling behaviors, having really well communicated policies, this is where training and talking about what we can do at the end of it is all really important. Because otherwise people just sit there and think, well, there's nothing that can be done to help me. I'll just get a new job.
So let me just pick up on that with you. If people are listening and thinking, God, that sounds like me. I really want to raise this as an issue. I know it's a problem. I know it's huge. I know it affects many more people, not just me. Where do they even start with that? Because it sounds like in order to get any kind of change or to really solve the problem, we need to go top level. It needs to be a huge thing. A, is that the case? And B, like, where do people even start with this? What would be your words of encouragement for getting started on fixing this?
My thing at the end of every training session, and bearing in mind, when I'm doing a training session, I've been asked to come in by the organization. I often get referred in via employees who have worked with me, who have had a call with me, or have sat through a webinar, and they've gone to their employer and said, hey, she was really great, can she come in here? And at the end of all of those webinars and training sessions, I say, throw me under the bus. Leave this meeting. And if you need to be safe, say, God, did you have to attend that training? Wasn't it shit? But do you remember that one thing she said? And just open the conversation. That's what I said earlier. If we can open the conversation, if we can ask, if we can stop assuming that we know all the answers, we can start to create outcomes. And whilst it might be, no, we don't have anything about it yet, let's see what we can do. It doesn't have to be top down at all. Culture is not created top down in any organization. It is co-created by everybody that's there. We have the policies and procedures and the things that we think is the culture. And then if it's done really well, it matches up with the reality, but often there's a disconnect between those two. So it's not mandated from above. And actually, I often deal with managers who are the squished middle. So they're high enough in the organization, they've got a lot of people underneath them, but they don't have enough power to make all the change by themselves. They're squished in the middle of it all. And this is where the business case comes in. This is where the, hey guys, you're going to make more money if, hey guys, we're going to stop having to pay recruiters if, whatever angle it is. But if we can talk about how we can create a better solution in-house without paying tens of thousands to recruiter fees or having to go to a tribunal, training's quite cheap, but I can buy an alternative, right? And then we open the door, we open the conversation, and then we go from there. So that's where it starts. And I would honestly say, if you are listening to this and you're not in a position to get training in, to raise that because you're worried about it, speak to somebody like one of us. We always love anonymous tips of who to follow on LinkedIn and who to stealthily connect to. But also remember, whilst individual solutions are not the be all and end all, they're a great place to start. If you're in an organization that you know is not going to support you, that doesn't mean you wait. Mm-hmm. We don't sit and wait for other people to fix everything. We start with our individual solutions to create more capacity and more resources. And then maybe you're going to leave and go somewhere that will support you. And that, again, is something that I can help with, you can help with. You know, I work, that's why I work with individuals as well as organizations, because we've got to have both sides of the coin.
I really like what you just said about that, about opening up those conversations, because even just on an individual level, if you're feeling defeated, if you're feeling overwhelmed at this and like, there is so much that needs to change, I can see the big picture, I can see how big it is, we're not going to rebuild it overnight. It's not always about that. And I say this with well-being all the time. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. We don't need to build Rome in a day. A 1% improvement is worth taking, because if it just takes the edge off your own day and makes you feel a little bit more in control, that has a massive ripple effect. That makes you feel better. That can make your team feel better. Like, it has more of an impact than people give themselves credit for. Yeah. Like you say, when it comes to even just on an individual level, I always say this with a lot of my coaching clients as well, is just get things out of your head. Because if you sit with things in your head, if you sit with stresses, if you sit with your concerns, it will only ever get worse in your head. As soon as you start externalizing it, whether that's in a conversation with a professional, a conversation with a stranger, even ranting to someone on the bus stop, like
talking to your dog on a walk, I'm fine with that.
It all helps and it all makes a difference. So we could get overwhelmed by the big picture, but as it with most things in life, if you just bring it back, what can I do right now? What can I do today? What can I do tomorrow? And actually, with things like this, I think I don't doubt there'll be so many people galvanized from this conversation today, because you've just said a load of things that people will be feeling, and they'll suddenly realize, fuck, it's not just me. Oh my God. And if one person goes and has that conversation with one other person in their office, and then there's two of them, and suddenly it's like, oh, maybe it's not just me that's experiencing this. Maybe this is something we're all experiencing. And then you're getting the ball rolling.
Yeah. It's a compound effect, right? If I can change my day 1% each day, that's a huge compound over time. And particularly with burnout, it is about that compound effect, because we're talking about resources, right? 77% of professionals have experienced burnout in their current job. That means 77% of people are not performing at their full capacity all of the time. What impact does that have on the whole organization? It's like pulling on one side of a spider's web. It will pull so far and then it will rip. So if we can create 1% here and 1% there and 1% there, we've suddenly got more slack in the system. There is more resource. There is more availability. And all of a sudden, that compound starts to really roll. But we need to start somewhere. And if that is taking a day off, if that is talking to a professional, if that is just having the conversation at work, and having the conversation is worth it. Because if you find out, nope, there's nothing we can do, there's nothing we will do, we do not believe in mental health, fine. At least you know, you can make an informed choice at that point. But actually, more often than not, you're surprised by what you say.
It makes me think of the argument around policy change versus protest, and like, actually, where does real change come from? And what we'll often find is it starts with the people. It starts with enough people saying enough is enough, protesting, maybe being quite disruptive. And this kind of period of discussion then takes place at a higher level where, like you said before, the top down comes to meet the bottom up solution.
Yeah.
In the middle of the real change. But it doesn't have to be a bad or a scary thing. It doesn't have to be like, oh my God, I spoke up. I was the first one to move. And now I've broken a system. A, sometimes system breaking is not a bad thing. But also, this is a really positive change that people can actually affect here. It can be a case of just saying, do you know what? I want to make my team feel better. I want to support other people. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, with some kind of practical takeaways here, what are some small things that people can do, particularly if they're managers? What are some small things you would suggest that they do maybe in the next 30 days or so to help move things in a better direction without it sounding too scary?
Next 30 minutes, ask your staff how they're doing and ask them what they've done today that they're proud of.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So we get so bogged down in, oh my God, this is systemic and it's huge and it's exhausting and I don't feel good. And instead, if we can start to reframe, what went well today? What do I feel proud of? What have I done recently I feel good about? All of a sudden, we're starting to create just a little ripple. It's not toxic positivity. We're not asking anybody to ignore the situation as a whole, but we're just trying to create a little bit of that, oh wait, it was worth coming to work today. Or if it wasn't, what am I going to improve tomorrow? So that's the first place that I start. The second place would be, and this is evidence-backed, Law Cares Life and the Law Study from 2021 found that the single biggest intervention that managers and law firms can have is to hold their one-to-ones with staff.
Oh God, and how often does that get overlooked or pushed back?
Because it doesn't have a monetary value attached to it, it's really easy to overlook it. And it's
an uncomfortable monetary value, like long-term, yeah. Absolutely does.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Long-term, it definitely does, because it's engagement, it's being seen. Being witnessed in burnout is absolutely huge, because we isolate and we hide away and we try and shoulder our symptoms. I talked about maladaptive coping mechanisms earlier. These are the things that we do to keep us functional but not fix the deeper issue. Coffee, wine, sugar at work, baking cakes, but also avoiding, not answering the WhatsApps, all these kind of things. So having a one-to-one cuts straight through all those maladaptive coping mechanisms and gets people to confront them without being confrontational. What's really going on? How are you really doing? No, really, how are you? So that's the second thing. Book the one-to-ones in. They don't have to be long. You don't have to promise to fix everything. Sometimes it can just be listening. Holding space and being empathetic is huge. Huge. It's a whole skill set. Then beyond that, start getting other people in. Because here's the other thing. If you're a manager, you've got to manage your own personal resources and that of your team. And then you're trying to affect change. That's two things too many on a list of three, because that's huge. And so this is where it isn't shameful to ask for support. It's actually more, I would argue, just, you know, throwing the gauntlet down at everybody, I think it's more shameful to not ask for support when we know that 3/4 of workers are experiencing this. If we knew how to fix it already, if you guys knew how to fix it already, you would do. And the reason why I'm not giving a 20-point map for every business is because every business is different. Mm-hmm. There are going to be things you do really well. There are things you don't do as well as you thought. There are things you thought you did really well that everybody else thinks you're doing crap at. That's where we need to have honest conversations. That's where we need to build in psychological safety. People can speak up. We facilitate the honest conversations, one-to-ones, feedback, anonymized reporting, 360 reviews. And then we start to create a plan. And the thing I'd say on top of that is be honest. Be honest with your organization, with your team. I don't have all the answers right now. I don't know, but I'm trying. How can I make things a little bit easier today? Because I'm going to have to look at short, medium, and long-term solutions. And in the short term, here, have some Percy Pigs. In the medium term, how can we reallocate some files, get some recruitment? How can we get the resources? How can we get the training? And then we'll create the long term. And you said earlier, sometimes systems need to be broken. There's two things I want to say to that.
The first is every system needs to be broken all the time. That's what iterative growth is. We do something, we figure out what works well about it, we figure out what doesn't work so well, and we change it. The second thing is nobody listening to this needs to worry about being the firebrand, about speaking out, about being a troublemaker. That's what we're for. That's what we do all day long, right? Is we troublemake in the best possible way so that other people don't have to. So you can accidentally put your podcast on loud so other people can hear it. You can say, hey, did you listen to this? I thought they were rubbish, but what about this one point? We start the conversation so you don't have to. These from the t-shirt, right?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, don't be the whistleblower, get us in with a foghorn.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that's the thing, come and speak to one of us first. Come get support, get therapy, whatever it is that you need to do in order to be facilitated to do this stuff. But don't take all the responsibility on yourself. It is a big, complex solution. I've been doing this for 6.5 years, and I can't say to you, without seeing the business, being involved with everybody and having discussions, here's what we're going to do 6 months from now. I can give you a 3 to 12 month plan of what I plan to do, and it's going to have to be adjusted. My own system is going to have to be broken to fix it, right? So let's stop thinking we should know all of the answers. Let's create the short and medium term, and let's work towards the long-term solution.
So just as a final point, where can people find you if they want to just follow your work and be equally obsessed? Where
So I am most often found being a renter gob on the internet on LinkedIn, linkedin.com/in/LeahYSteele, STWLE, or find me at hello@searchingforserenity.co.uk or my website, searchingforserenity.co.uk.
Fabulous. I'll put all the links in the show notes below, which I'll direct people to. But yes, thank you so much. And if you don't know where to start, I think the best place is just to get in touch with you directly and have a chat, right?
Yeah. Send me a message. Tell me you don't think you're burned out yet, but you're just really tired and you're really struggling and you don't know why you bother. And we'll take it from there.
And she will tell you you're wrong.
In the best possible way.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Hello, lovely. It's Alice here again. One more time, I just wanted to impress upon you the importance of getting in touch with Leah. Hopefully after today's episode, you've heard what she had to say. You're obsessed in exactly the same way that I am with her and what she can do and the insights that she has. Please don't be intimidated by the scale of the conversation today. I feel like she made it very accessible and very much like she's taken a big scary topic and gone from, oh my God, what can we do? Let's panic, to actually, here are some really practical things we can do. So she talked about the importance of working on individual solutions and how that can be the real catalyst for change. She spoke about acknowledging the problem and opening these conversations and how important that is as a first step of just going, do you know what? We're not on our own. There are things we can do about it. And very importantly as well, she makes the point of, you as an individual do not need to feel like a whistleblower in your organisation. You do not need to put yourself in a situation where you're seen to be a troublemaker or for talking about anything untoward. That is not what your role needs to be. The entire point of a lot of wellbeing facilitators is to be that rabble-rouser, for lack of a better word. We're there to blow a foghorn and to raise attention around these issues. So if you feel like you want to get some support and you want to get someone in, talk to myself, talk to Leah, go and do some investigation around other wellbeing supporters who can come into your organisation and help you with their expertise. They can do it in a safe and responsible way so that they are looking after the psychological safety of your people, but they're able to help you to put some actions in place to turn the boat around and to go in a better direction. So as I said at the beginning, all of Leah's information and contact details are in the show notes. Check her out at searchingforserenity.co.uk, find her on LinkedIn, make her your friend, tell her I sent you, and you'll be laughing and you'll be doing a great thing for your organisation and your people. Thank you so much for today. Keep on being a badass at work, and I will talk to you next time.